You're listening to World Class from the Freeman Spogli Institute for International Studies at Stanford University. We bring international affairs expertise from Stanford's campus straight to you. I'm Nicole Feldman, and today we're talking about civil wars. When most of us think about civil wars, we tend to think about fighting in one country. But these days, fighting in a single state can kind of creep across borders and end up affecting a lot of other countries as well. In the fall and winter issues of Daedalus, which is the Journal of the American Academy of Arts and Sciences, 8 scholars here at FSI talk about the threats of conflict in regions around the world. Today we're joined by Carl Eikenberry and Steve Krasner, who co-edited the Daedalus volumes on civil wars and global disorder. Carl spent 35 years in the U.S. Army before leaving his post as Lieutenant General to serve as the U.S. Ambassador to Afghanistan. Here at FSI, he's the Oxenberg Rowland Fellow at the Shorenstein Asia-Pacific Research Center and directs its U.S.-Asia Security Initiative. So a little longer ago than we'll admit here on the air, he was also a student of Steve Krasner's. Steve is the Graham H. Stewart Professor of International Relations here at FSI. So Carl and Steve, thank you so much for joining us today.
Good to be here, Nicole.
Happy to be here.
So the two of you gathered experts from across Stanford and around the world to talk about the ways that civil wars have changed, how their effects can be global, and what we can do about them. So what inspired you to start this project? Carl, let's start with you. You've had some pretty interesting experiences with war. What made this topic stand out for you?
Nicole, it was really my experiences in Afghanistan, which began on 9/11 when I was in the Pentagon and American Airlines Flight 88, commandeered by al-Qaeda terrorist, crashed into the Pentagon. So that was my introduction to the war in Afghanistan. A year later, I was a major general serving in Kabul, helping the Afghans to build their security forces. A couple of years later, I went back to Afghanistan as the coalition commander. And then, as you had said in the introduction, from 2009 to 2011, I was the U.S. ambassador in Afghanistan. And Nicole, for me to spend a decade in Afghanistan and with this very massive intervention, not only by the United States, but our NATO allies, by the entire international community, all with the very best of intentions in our efforts to bring stability to the country, to help the Afghans develop political institutions, security forces, to help them develop their economy, to see the massive expenditure of efforts and resources, the number of forces that we committed, the number of casualties that were inflicted upon our forces and our allied forces, and then to measure that against the results, which in some areas are actually impressive, but in the main, we would have to say, are rather disappointing. And so when I left Afghanistan with those deep experiences and came here to Stanford, I was pondering those problems and then meeting and people like Steve Krasner, Frank Fukuyama, Steve Stedman, professors here at Stanford that have thought hard about these problems. It led me then to conclude that perhaps it was worthwhile to get this tremendous intellectual capital that we have at Stanford together under the auspices of the American Academy of Arts and Sciences and to study this question of civil wars, interstate violence, and international responses.
And Steve, can you tell us a little bit about what inspired you to join the project?
I've been a professor of international relations for many decades, more than I would care to admit at this point. But if you look at the international environment in the past, the major wars have really been wars among major powers. There hasn't been a war among major powers since 1945. But there have been lots of civil wars. So I think one of the major security challenges for the United States and for other industrialized countries is how it addresses questions of civil wars in mostly fragile or poorly governed states, understanding with some clarity what the impact of civil wars might be on wealthier parts of the world, and thinking seriously about what realistic policy options are available to us.
So the two of you both, you know, had a lot of experience. I mean, it sounds like from fairly different sides of the issue when coming together. When you started reaching out to other scholars, Carl, what questions were we trying to answer?
Three big ones. The first was to examine what is the trends, especially since the end of the Cold War, in civil wars and interstate violence. The second was looking at that set of countries, then those states that are afflicted with civil wars or just recovering from long-term violence, to ask the question, are there new threats that could be emerging from these countries different than the past? What do I mean by a new threat? So the question of international terrorism, the possibility of pandemics spreading from countries that are afflicted with interstate violence, refugees. The third question that we wanted to address was, given this, then what would be the appropriate international responses and regional responses to external actors interested in trying to deliver stability and security to these countries?
And as you, you know, got this project going, how were you able to decide who to include in the project?
Well, what Steve and I did is that we were, first of all, very interested in getting diversity of disciplines. So we made that one category. And then secondly, we also wanted to get people that had expertise from outside of the United States, and not only from Europe, but in particular from countries that have suffered from civil wars. So example on the interdisciplinary approach, we have political scientists, we have policy practitioners, somebody like myself who've served in the as a diplomat and as a soldier, Jean-Marie Guajeno, who are very active within the United Nations, Steve Stedman, both a scholar and somebody with a lot of firsthand United Nations experience, Lise Doucette, a renowned international correspondent, Canadian with BBC World. And then secondly, internationally, I think that we did do well in getting the diversity that we sought. So we have scholars not only from Europe, but we have two brilliant authors from Ethiopia that talk about the Ethiopian experience vis-a-vis Somalia and within their region. We have an excellent scholar from Colombia who talks about their extended civil war and the war against FARC. We have somebody with deep experience in South Asia. So we were happy that we were able to bring together this very eclectic group, both geographically and in terms of discipline.
Yeah, that sounds like a great way to approach this. So the two of you talk about a shift in the way that civil wars work and how they start affecting civilians differently after the Cold War. So, Steve, can you tell us a little bit about how civil wars have changed in the last 20 years or so?
There were lots of civil wars during the Cold War period and into the 1990s. The number of new civil wars has actually decreased, but the duration of civil wars has grown in duration, so that the actual number has not decreased very substantially. James Furon, who's one of our contributors and also a professor at Stanford, outlines that set of developments very well. In thinking about the consequences of civil wars, I mean, both Carl and I served in the government for a few years in the State Department, so we've had some practical experience as well. And it's pretty evident. I mean, I think it was both evident to Carl and me that while there's been lots of thinking both in academia and in policy circles about how to deal with conflicts among major powers, there's tremendous disagreement about civil wars, whether or not they're actually consequential, and if they are consequential, what might be done about them. So two threats from civil wars we identified, I think, very clearly. One is very familiar, that is transnational terrorism. The second, though, and this was something that two of our colleagues in the medical school helped us to think about, are pandemic diseases. So most of the new diseases that have broken out in the last 40 or 50 years are diseases that have jumped from animals to people. Mm-hmm. We've been lucky so far, if you think about AIDS or Ebola, transmission has been actually difficult. It's been through bodily fluids, but there is no reason to think that transmission wouldn't be airborne. And you could have a global pandemic that could kill millions or tens of millions of people. These kind of pandemic diseases are most likely to occur in badly governed states, especially in tropical areas where human beings are encroaching onto areas that were previously just inhabited by animals. And thinking about an effective monitoring mechanism as well as a response mechanism is something that our colleagues really helped us to think deeply about. And, you know, if there is a sweet spot for Stanford, it is the intersection of technical knowledge and public policy. And I think we've done very well in that regard in thinking about this issue of pandemic diseases. There are then a series of other kinds of bads that can emanate from conflict situations. Great power conflict is one of them. Regional destabilization is another. Refugee flows, transnational criminality. So the bads are not limited to terrorism and pandemic diseases. But it is clear that terrorism and pandemic diseases could potentially kill millions of people in wealthy parts of the world.
Sure. Well, let's talk a little bit about some of the other effects. So pandemics seem like one way in which civil wars can kind of cross borders and spread out across the world. Can you tell us about some other ways that might happen?
So we do know that if you're thinking about civil wars, they're certainly clustered. They certainly affect neighboring countries. Neighboring countries have been able to deal with civil wars with varying degrees of efficacy. Our African colleagues who participated in this project have a very interesting essay about the way in which essentially Ethiopia has dealt with Somalia, which is a failed state on its borders. So there's a kind of contagion effect that simply is the result of a neighborhood effect. There are also contagion effects that might result from the involvement of great powers in civil wars, which we're seeing more now than we saw in the 1990s. Russia's engagement in Syria is one obvious example of that. So if we're thinking about the spread of civil wars and the impact then, if you're thinking about refugee flows, can be far-flung. Neighborhood effects, the engagement of great powers are, at least two of the ways in which, wars can potentially spread. And then, if you think about refugees, disease, transnational terrorism, the impact of these wars can be global, even though the wars themselves might be isolated in particular countries or particular regions.
I think as well, Nicole, that as we looked at the history of efforts by external actors to try to bring civil wars to closure since the end of the Cold War, one of the interesting findings was, and this was very much Steve Stedman, colleague here at Stanford, his analysis is that in the main, the record of peacekeeping efforts by the United Nations and by the international community is not really all that bad since the end of the Cold War. So at the end of the Cold War, you have a rise in the number of civil wars. And what starts to emerge actually towards the end of the Cold War, but then accelerates in the 1990s, is the development of what's called the international treatment regime. And the international treatment regime is the idea that combinations of external mediation along with peacekeeping forces, together with some degree of development assistance, can be the formula to bring to closure a civil war or bring down levels of interstate violence. And if you look at the track record in the 1990s and into the first decade of this century, that over 40% of the civil wars that were successfully brought to a conclusion were mediated by the United Nations. This idea of mediating civil war, trying to mediate, bring in peacekeepers, that's something that didn't exist during the Cold War when it was a zero-sum game between the United States and the Soviet Union. Mm-hmm. So the underappreciated, the degree of success which has been achieved. But to Steve's point about the concern with great power rivalry, with the diffusion of global power and the United States now not having the preeminence that it did at the end of the Cold War, and now challengers, whether it be China, whether it be Russia, questions now starting to emerge whether or not this international treatment regime will still be an appropriate model to deal with the many problems that are out there, and a degree of skepticism that it might be. Certainly what we're seeing in the civil wars in North Africa and in the Middle East, which are primarily led by Islamic jihadist groups, to which there will be no compromise, that would be one condition already in which the international treatment regime as it developed, or the standard treatment regime as it developed, would not be appropriate, because if the fighting if the forces that are fighting on the ground don't want to compromise, one wants the creation of a regime that is not of this world, but it's a regime of the divine, and another is fighting for retention of secular state power, then there may be no room for compromise there.
Right. Well, then let's talk a little bit more about what we might be able to do about this. So, so Steve, how do you think that policymakers can be addressing these issues? And talk to us a little more about the challenges.
The most important conclusion, I think, from the two volumes is that we need to have modest objectives. There is some consensus on that in American academia. I would say some consensus in Europe, no consensus in Washington, D.C. or the American government about what the possibilities might be for ending civil wars. So what, you know, what we argue for is that in the end, in most of the countries that we're dealing with, the best that we can hope for is good enough governance, which means some degree of security, some degree of economic growth, improvements in health, because these are beneficial to even very corrupt leaders, and possibly some protection of human rights. But as Carl said, if you look at the standard treatment regime, which is was a surprise to me, I have to say, in doing this volume, I mean, how effective it has been, still its effectiveness requires certain conditions. It requires that the participants in a civil war not be seeking millenarian objectives, that they're seeking objectives on earth and not in heaven. It requires some consensus among the great powers. So if the Russians, the Americans, and the Chinese disagree, you're not going to be able to deploy UN peacekeepers. It means the participants in civil wars have to recognize that they're in a hurting stalemate in which neither party can win. There have been cases, although not very many, and Sri Lanka is one, and we actually have an essay about Sri Lanka in our two volumes, where the government was able to prevail ultimately. They did win. They did defeat the dissident Tamil group within the country. But the main lesson, which I think should be drawn from the two volumes, is that we're not going to turn these countries into Denmark or put them on the path to Denmark. Mm-hmm. That what we should aim for is good enough governance, and good enough governance is a set of modest objectives. In some cases, we might be able to use UN peacekeepers as standard treatment, as Carl suggested, to accomplish that. In other cases, the standard treatment won't be available. But in either case, whether we're using the standard treatment or not, we have to think about modest goals, not thinking that we can turn these countries into modern democracies.
Sure. Well, it sounds like the two of you have a great handle on, you know, where we should go next. So tell us a little bit more about what your future plans are. So the Daedalus works we've been talking about are just the beginning. The two of you have some big plans to kind of take this from papers to actual policy. So tell us a little bit about that. What's coming next?
Well, Nicole, when Steve and I put this project together, we had two requests from the American Academy. And one was that we'd have a free hand in recruiting the authors and co-authors, and we received that. And then secondly, we had asked that there be a so-called outreach phase that would follow with the publication of these two volumes of Daedalus. And so rather than just have two volumes of Daedalus published, they're put on the bookshelf and everyone moves on, the idea that this is really the launching point now for further exploration of this topic of civil wars and international response. So we have already have underway a very active outreach program where Steve had, with several of Stanford colleagues and colleagues in the project, had gone to New York City and had 2 days of very interesting meetings with the United Nations. So we've already begun the outreach program now, beginning actually in September, I think it was, Steve, that you Right. and several colleagues from Stanford and co-authors had gone to New York City, had some good meetings with the United Nations, and those continued over the next several months. In January, we're planning to have several of our authors that will convene in Washington, D.C., partnered with the United States Institute for Peace, and we'll have an opportunity to launch Volume 2. But while we're in Washington, D.C., setting up a set of engagements with the National Security Council in the Pentagon and the Department of State and USAID, the idea being that we talk about our project and our ideas and test these with a group of practitioners who then give us feedback on their views of feasibility. So the we're really benefiting on both sides of the table. Maybe most interesting is the international outreach that we're doing. We began this last month where Paul Weiss, global health expert here at Stanford and one of our colleagues in this study, and I, with several others, went to Abuja in Nigeria and met with Nigerian government and military officials and NGOs with the same idea that we'd talk about our findings, but more listen. And that was a wonderful session that we had over a several-day period. We also aim in the months ahead to have a outreach to Colombia, to Ethiopia, possibly to South Asia, to Sri Lanka, and to the Balkans. And then at the end of all of this, perhaps in about 12 or 18 months, Steve and I will be then co-writing or co-authoring a occasional paper where we'll take the ideas that we started with as a result of the publication of the Daedalus volumes, but then having an opportunity internationally here in the United States with our government and with the United Nations to refine and advance our thinking. And this monograph that we publish will be very policy prescriptive and very policy oriented.
Great. Steve, is there anything you'd like to add?
No, the only thing I would say is that in the United States, and maybe even the U.S. and Europe, there's kind of an echo chamber. So Carla's already been to Nigeria. I'm very interested in seeing what the response of people in countries that have been afflicted with civil wars actually will be. So I think hearing what Ethiopians have to say about our project, Colombians, ideally Sri Lankans, people from the Balkans, will be extremely interesting. Because it's very easy, I think, if you're sitting in the U.S. to think, well, we're going to try and turn all these countries into Western Europe or the U.S. What other kinds of alternatives might be acceptable in the developing world is simply not so obvious, and I think not obvious in policy circles. So I think our outreach, one thing that is, if not unique, very unusual about this project is the degree of outreach which we're going to try and have in countries that are not part of the OECD world already.
Sure.
And Nicole, I can give you an example from Nigeria. Mm-hmm. So 3.5 days in Abuja, talking to Nigerian officials, Nigerian military, and NGOs, as I had said, two very interesting observations. One is that as the United States from a distance looks at Nigeria in terms of security implications, we, the United States, think about Boko Haram. That is the problem from the United States perspective. You go inside of Nigeria, and there'll be an agreement that Boko Haram is a problem. Mm-hmm. Maybe it's the majority-minority problem that exists in terms of security. But they have problems. They, the Nigerian authorities, will say, but we've got problems in the Delta. We have problems in the Southeast. we have criminal problems in this particular part of the country. So they'll say that Boko Haram, maybe with the 100% of the security bin, they'll say that Boko Haram is maybe 30% of their problems. Now, that causes then big problems for the United States as we try to align our interests, because our security assistance program, our foreign assistance programs, it's all very much filtered through Boko Haram. Mm-hmm. And that can lead to dysfunctional outcomes, or at least less than efficient outcomes on the ground. Second was this discussion that we had with Paul Weiss there about Ebola and the threat. There, I would say that the Nigerian officials that we met with were very, very interested in Paul's analysis. And so I think that we've begun a very good dialogue between Paul's efforts and Nigeria, which is a critical country, which is critical, given its size, to all of West Africa, to include the countries that were directly afflicted with the 2014 Ebola crisis.
Yeah, well, it sounds like you guys are getting some really interesting perspectives. And for our listeners, we are going to be following Steve and Carl as they work through all of these issues in different places around the world. So to keep up on everything they're doing, follow us on Twitter at FSI Stanford. You can also find us on Facebook and Instagram, and we'll be posting as many photos and videos from their trips as we can. Keep listening here on World Class, and we'll be talking a bit more about civil wars as well. So Steve and Carl, thank you both so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks, Nicole.
And you've been listening to World Class from the Freeman Spogli Institute for International Studies at Stanford University. Subscribe for more events and expertise from the world of international studies.